I know more about sports than you, good sir.
Tis to laugh. Dare I say my grandmother could outsport you any day of the week.
Gentlemen, may I borrow your ear for a moment?
But of course!
BetDSI.net is an awesome site where you can play for free and win real cash. Are you a sports nut with a lot of confidence?
Thoroughly.
Maybe you're a casual fan with a flair for the stats.
Guilty!
Put your knowledge to the test and win real cash at BetDSI.net. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's just another way to enjoy the sport you already love. It's BetDSI.net.
Huzzah!
It's not just that Bob is brilliant. It also helps that everyone else isn't as smart. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Still Wednesday, the 25th of May, 2016, hour number 3 of 3 on Primetime Sports. It's Canada's most listened to sports talk show on the Sportsnet radio and television networks coast to coast. I'm Bob McCowan. That is John Shannon right over there.
Robert.
A little bit later on, Brent Berry will join us.
Yeah, he'll explain why the Cavs will win tonight.
Or lose tonight.
Okay.
Barry Melrose will be with us.
Wow.
ESPN hockey analyst. He'll explain why you can't pick anything in,
in the sport
of hockey.
Barry's going to talk about one of his old coaches, John Brophy.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
Brophy passing away at age 83?
Yes, sir.
The other day?
Yep.
But we'll also talk about the Sharks and the Blues.
You might
and
have an
maybe
opinion
Pittsburgh
or two.
And Tampa as well. That's all to come. But first, it's our distinct pleasure to be joined by the former host of, oh God, I don't have long enough to list all the shows.
Well, we only have 20 minutes.
No, I got 59 minutes, but I still don't have enough time. Here's Keith Olbermann. Mr. Olbermann, how are you?
Bob, nice to talk to you. Hello, John. How are you?
Good, Keith.
It's nice of you. Nice of me to be able to introduce you two guys in a more formal environment. You've never been in the same room together, but apparently, Olbermann, you and Shannon are pen pals now. Is that right?
It's pretty close.
Yeah, Twitter is a wonderful thing. I have people whose work I admire, who I'm not likely to run into here on the streets of New York, are accessible within seconds. It's what a world we live in, gentlemen.
It's the one key thing I think that Keith and I have in common is our love of hockey minutia, and so we tend to get off on rants and discussion points about expansion and hockey in the 30s, hockey in the 50s, and what it was like to be at the old Madison Square Garden, right?
Exactly how long the Philadelphia Quakers lasted and
that's
things
right.
like that. Yeah. I was at the old Garden, but not for a game. I went to the Garden. I was so young when the old Garden closed. All I saw in it was the circus. However, I am old enough to have gone to an NHL game in the Garden's second full year of operation. So I'm old enough. And you just mentioned John Brophy. I mean, I remember John Brophy of the Long Island Ducks.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
And then much later on, to me, it's still one of the more remarkable things I ever saw in sports. When he was coaching in the league, did he not, at the point where his hair was the whitest and he looked the most like the underdog cartoon character Simon Bar Sinister, when he had that full white fro going, did he not get hit by a puck
in Montreal
in the head?
Yeah.
And he was bleeding bright red through the white hair, and he just kept on coaching with the blood gradually saturating. My memory is of every time they'd do the cutaway. We showed these on the highlights. I would have been doing the local news in L.A., and each time they cut to him, he was a little redder and a little less white. It was just extraordinary. I mean, playing hurt, my goodness, he's bleeding up there.
Brophy always reminded me of Spencer Tracy in The Old Man and the Sea. And I guess just the white hair and kind of, well, halfway disheveled look that he had. What's your history as a hockey fan? How did you get interested in the sport?
My uncle, Uncle Willie, who was actually my mother's uncle, attended both, and I'd like to emphasize this, there were only two home games for the 1940 Rangers in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Mm.
And he used to talk fondly of John Ross Roach, a goaltender of the 20s and 30s who was briefly with the Rangers and briefly the Ranger goalie. And he had taken my mother to games, and he He was the sports historian in my family, and I can't remember exactly what drew me to it, but I do know that maybe the second thing I ever wrote about sports was for the fourth grade newspaper, and it was about this is as telling a statistic as you will find on this topic, I think. It was about the Toronto Maple Leafs winning the Stanley Cup in 1967 when I was in the fourth grade. One of
Very
the
good.
First things I ever wrote about sports. And then they showed the games on TV, and there wasn't a lot on TV.
Right.
As many fans have gotten hooked in that way. And I started to listen to the Rangers on the radio. Marv Albert was the Rangers radio man.
Mm-hmm.
Great radio hockey man. It was just tremendously exciting. Great teams, and Eddie Jockeman in goal. And I started to go in 1969. And the first game to this day, I can remember my disappointment because the first or second game I ever saw in person, the Blues were in, and I knew that meant that I was going to see either Jacques Plante or Glenn Hall.
Right.
And for days, it was, I'm going to see Jacques Plante. And I knew the whole story, and I'd seen him on TV, or Hall. If he thought, I'm going to see Hall, Ernie Wakely.
No.
To this day, I'm nothing against Ernie Wakely, but to this day, I feel ripped off. So that was where I became a fan then, and remain such. I wavered a little bit after the lockouts, both on frustration and principle levels. And I found myself recapturing my exuberance as a fan in the last, certainly 5-10 years. And it's the last thing, it's the last sporting event I can go to, you know, wearing a shirt, wearing a jersey and root. And I stood there last year. I think I missed one Ranger home playoff game and stood there and agonized with them. And come to think of it, this year I only missed one Ranger home playoff game as well. So it's been I'm a Ranger fan, therefore I'm long suffering. But Ranger fans know you are not allowed to leave. The only way out is death.
Let me remind you, 1994 is not near as far away as 1967. So
yeah,
don't
man.
Talk about long suffering.
Yeah, no, I know. I shouldn't point that out. I was at one of the final games in 79, and I saw one of the wins against Vancouver in 94 with a friend of mine who was probably the last guy you would presume was a hockey fan, Wally Joyner, the former American League first baseman with the Angels in Kansas City, native of Atlanta. I was shocked. He was with the Angels, and I was a rookie sportscaster in L.A. And I said, "How are you a hockey fan? You're a real Southerner from Atlanta." He said, "He grew up living next door to the guy who won the name the team contest for the Atlanta Flames." So he became a hockey fan at whatever, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And Wally and I went to a game of the finals in '94. And you know, there's a lot of tremendous memories. And I also, I went to Cornell. So two or three of my classmates, and including one fairly good friend of mine, became NHL players. A fellow named Lance Nethery, who played a year for the Rangers.
I remember him.
Great fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he became a star in Germany.
You and the commissioner, the same alma mater.
Yes, well, I try to play that down. What is fascinating is, of course, the commissioner of Major League Baseball is also from Cornell and was there when Bettman was a law student. He was there before I was there, right before, like the year before. But Rob Manfred was class of 1980, and I was class of 79. So the likelihood that we ran into each other or were in a class together is not bad. But so I was at Cornell. And then in my first job in broadcasting as a professional, I worked for Sam Rosen, who was now the voice of the New York Rangers.
Right.
He was my boss, and we covered, Sam and I covered for United Press International's radio network. Wow. We covered the 1980 Olympics. And my assignment originally, because Sam knew it wasn't going to be much of the tournament for the United States, my assignment, just turned 21, was to cover the U.S. hockey team. And, of course, after they won the first few games, Sam joined me in the coverage.
Oh, I'm shocked.
Yeah. But he'd already done NHL play-by-play. I couldn't really – and he was my boss. I really couldn't complain. But so we both covered it, and I was therefore given this incredibly difficult task of getting the free seat, the ticket. He sat in the press box were the two big games, for the Russia game and the gold medal game. And I covered the crowd. So my entire responsibility was to sit at basically 30 rows up from center ice at the Olympic Auditorium in Lake Placid, and then go out a couple of seconds beforehand and interview fans chanting USA in the crowd outside. So I have my standing with the National Hockey League and international hockey is pretty long standing.
Baseball or hockey? What would you put at your top of your list? Baseball as a business and hockey as a fan?
Well, honestly, beware of increasing replay. Baseball with replay is beginning to lose me, and I never thought I'd say that out loud. Mm. But the fact that eventually we will be using microscopes to determine whether or not Bartolo Colon's left cheek actually touched second base or went over it by 1/10,000th of an inch. This is where we're headed to this. We're going down to the level that football or even the NBA is doing, where it's lost the original intent of what replay was supposed to show, to the point I'm in favor of getting rid of replay altogether. And as I think I mentioned, I can't remember who I told this to, I think the NHL, and I can't remember when it was really done, I thought the greatest, most important, most exciting rule change in the last 25 years in any sport was enacted by the NHL and is barely recognized today, and that was the virtual elimination of freezing the puck against the boards.
Mm-hmm.
Because you now have uninterrupted action, and it's no longer, you know, we're breaking into your tonight's exciting edition of Perry Mason to tell you that there were 7 uninterrupted minutes of action in a sporting event. It's every night. Even in the playoffs, it's fantastic. It makes the NBA look like dripping molasses by comparison. And baseball is now moving towards this. So I begin to wonder, as a born and bred baseball fan, if I'm not, in fact, a born and bred hockey fan whose hockeyness is overcoming his baseballness.
Dare I remind you, we had a 6-minute video review last night in the Tampa Pittsburgh game?
Well, all right, but you had, I mean, how many of them did you have?
Oh, no, just one.
Sorry, but I'm saying, if it's manageable and if it's in the playoffs and it's decisive, I think you can handle it. But unfortunately, it is the genie and the bottle. There's no way to stop it, because once it happens, it's going to continue to happen and get more sophisticated and more time consuming. And it is a danger. I don't think we'll ever go back to no replays, but if I had a choice of only those two extremes, I would go with no replays, because it's killing baseball, particularly. I mean, if you're at home, you can get up and do something. But in baseball, it's this. Ron Darling, the great Yale-educated Mets announcer, said it perfectly. You see this extraordinary play. A stadium rises up in seeing the perfect mathematics of the game. And this could apply to hockey as easily as baseball. And then you see this happen, and you're on your feet. And then you go, now, let's spend 5 minutes determining whether or not it was a mirage.
Mm.
And just suck the air out of the whole process. And I worry to some degree that might happen in the NHL.
Well,
but it hasn't yet, but it has in baseball.
With Keith Olbermann, you know, 2 days ago, I took a phone call from a fan, and it's interesting you brought this topic up, Keith, because fan said to me, why on earth do we not use replay instead of home plate umpires to call balls and strikes? Given, you know, if you watch on television, you get the little box in the top corner, and the perception is that is accurate and that many calls are missed. And there's some truth to that. And technologically, we could probably be there right now if we really wanted to be. And it's hard for me to say, this is why you won't see it happen. I don't know if you won't.
I think you will. I mean, I don't know that anybody actually would have said 40 years ago that tennis would be ruled entirely by electronic beeps,
sure. Hawkeye,
whether
yeah.
the ball was in or out.
Yeah.
And you know, there is an argument to be made that of all the things you'd like to have done automatically, balls and strikes might make the most sense. And you could eliminate a whole facet of time wasting in the game by permitting that. I mean, I think that's sensors and technological improvements in that way in all sports. I don't think it's ruined tennis by any stretch of the imagination. Perhaps you could argue that the life has been lost because there isn't a John McEnroe having a near nervous breakdown on every call that goes against him. But there is also something to be said for that might actually hasten the pace of a baseball game, and it might be applicable in hockey or other sports too. But I think that's almost a separate issue from going back and, as I said, you know, we will be using microscopes eventually, and you can see it almost on there. Now you can see on the offsides call. That's the future. And if you can't make the first thing is to save it in any sport, you have to have a time limit. And perhaps the best way is to let the referee or the umpire, depending on which game it is, let them choose, eliminate the coach's challenge, just let them go and say, okay, I'm not sure I want to see it again. Leave it in their hands and give them essentially a reward every time they go and use it, because then they'll be, you know, skeptical of that they saw everything, but not, you know, there won't be an ego involved in it, in other words. But this way lies madness. So it's a very odd answer to the question, am I a baseball guy or a hockey guy, but there it is.
Another baseball question we got into the other day, and it is topical, and it's not one that you're unfamiliar with, and that is minorities as managers in Major League Baseball. We have two African-American managers. We had one Latino who was fired in Atlanta, who, along with his primary assistant, Carlos Tosca. And we addressed the question, all right, how do you fix this? If we perceive there is a problem here, and most people suggest something's going on, whether it's a problem or not remains to be seen. Do you have any thoughts on what you can do? Clearly, mandating Latino interviews for managerial positions or African-Americans to be interviewed is perceived as a scam and not real.
Yeah.
Is there an answer?
I don't know, because I think largely what the reason there seems to have been some backing up in this topic in baseball. It's a part of the law of unintended consequences. We are, as much as sports writers, broadcasters, even some fans resist metrics and sabermetrics and analytics and all of that. Mm-hmm. The game has clearly embraced it. And what you're now looking for in your average general manager is somebody who can do an adequate job of the eye test on any given player or the negotiation test with any other general manager, but principally can handle analytics and statistics and can provide you with a cost benefit analysis of getting a third baseman of a particular, you know, name or origin. But the problem is literally, I think two of these guys are from Cornell, or maybe it's three, and they tend to be pasty white guys. And necessarily, these pasty white general managers are going to have, from their field of experience in baseball, their experience is going to be other pasty white guys. And so we now knock this process back, which I think, after some obvious delay in baseball coming to the realization that Al Campanis and people who thought like him should not be making these decisions, I think they were making progress towards a nice balance and an appropriate position where every job was judged on who was best for the job, and there were enough minority candidates that you got a good percentage of minority managers. But now you have these new general managers who don't know any of these people, who don't know who's been in the organization for 30 years, who wouldn't know Lloyd McClendon if they didn't have a statistic on how often he changed pitchers. And that's your problem. And I don't know how you overcome that other than the proverbial sensitivity training. I don't know what you could mandate, because I think it's
I don't either.
your point about the interviews is I think completely right. It's a scam in all sports.
This is the longest interview you've gone without talking about Donald Trump, so we won't let you talk about him.
Well, are you got your condo listed?
We believe it's very close to sale. I'll know in the morning.
You're not moving into another Trump condo, are you?
No, I moved out already. I'm
okay, good.
The financial hit. I had to get out with my soul before it got sucked into the vortex of Castle Trumpula, which I can see out my new window as I speak to you now, glowing in the distance.
Uh-oh.
With evil. Okay, so you said you opened the door, John.
I know.
There's plenty of construction happening here in Toronto in anticipation of a flood of Americans wishing to move to Canada if Trump is elected president. So you're welcome.
Am I not calling the line that allows me to apply for the equivalent of a green card? Is that it?
100%.
Okay, that's what the interview is for. Okay.
That's exactly what this is all about, and you're welcome. Thanks very much for taking some time for us. We enjoyed it greatly, and somewhere down the road, we'd love to talk to you again. Thanks, Keith.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, John.
All right. Boy.
Keith Olbermann, former host of Olbermann on ESPN and SportsCenter and a whole bunch
Fox,
of other stuff.
MSNBC.
Easier to mention
the networks he hasn't worked for.
The Toronto Raptors play the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 5 tonight. If you've been off the planet, yes, it's true. It's Game 5. And no, Cleveland is not able to clinch this series tonight. It is tied at 2 apiece. Who'd have thunk it? Not my co-host today. Brent Berry of the NBA on TNT and NBA TV has covered, I believe, Brent, 4 playoff games involving the Raptors. Is that right, to the best of your knowledge?
Hello, Green Card Dispatch. Oh, wait, it's Bob and John. Hey, guys.
How you doing?
Just playing off of Keith.
Yeah.
I got smarter listening to Keith Olbermann, I think, for the last couple minutes.
We all do, don't we? Don't we? Yeah.
He's unbelievable.
So you've seen this Raptor team perform, probably at its best and at its worst. And
yeah, maybe not this team that you've watched the last few games. I watched a couple of the earlier ones, which somehow, some way, digging in and digging out, they've got this thing tied up. Amazing stuff.
Well, now you combine that 2-2 in the Cleveland-Toronto series and 3-1 in the Oak City series. Holy smokes, this is not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, you know, the other series is a little bit more, I guess, believable with regards to, you know, what OKC represents. I think just a lot of people have underplayed how good offensively Oklahoma City has been throughout the year and what they're capable of doing, and everybody thinking they were the most dangerous team if they...
Oops. Well, see if we can get it back. Signal just dropped. Don't know exactly why. Sounded like an abrupt interruption.
He's another one of those guys like me that is just surprised that the Raptors have been able to do what they have done the last two games, and in many ways the question is, can they put 3 consistent offensive games together in order to really put Cleveland on their heels?
Yeah, and look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I projected that the Toronto Raptors would win 2 games in the postseason in this series. I did not, but I thought that the series had a chance to be closer than you thought it would be.
Obviously,
that's all I've said. But what I am now saying is, you can't make the Toronto Raptors favorites in a series where 2 games are going to be played on the road.
Right.
If you go 7, the prospect of winning one in Cleveland is daunting, but no longer viewed as impossible by me. And I wonder what... Is Brent back?
Yep.
Brent returns.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys.
That's okay. I'm wondering whether, in your experience as a player and watching these games, it's not so much about momentum for me, it's about doubt. And I wonder whether the fact that Cleveland not only lost for the first time, but lost for the first time in the playoffs... Swept their first series, swept their second series, won the first 2 games of this series comfortably, started talking about the possibility of 16-0. Not that they got ahead of themselves, but that they had no doubt in their minds that they were going to win and win comfortably. Is there doubt in Cleveland among the Cavaliers right now as they get ready for Game 5?
I'll go more with a reassessment of their focus. It's funny because that word about having some doubt or even the sense of humility has crept into both of these series with regards to the Warriors and maybe about
for sure.
Some of their arrogance getting a little bit ahead of where they were, and maybe for good reason. I mean, you just had the best regular season in history. And then for Cleveland, thinking about the mission at hand, which is we are returning to the finals to play against Golden State. And wouldn't it be something to rack up every win before it is that we're going to play game 1 in Oakland? Mm-hmm. And maybe neither one of those scenarios happening has a lot of people who follow this league fascinated by the potential of what tonight can mean. And I think for Toronto, you know, the one thing that they've gained is not just their confidence, but that, you know, they've gotten the attention of Cleveland And we'll see if Cleveland can turn that laser focus around onto them and really do something very difficult. And that is to change around what ended up being a successful formula for all those wins for Cleveland to start to play this three-point bombing, move the ball around, and we're just going to fire the first available three that's given to us type of offense, which was setting records until they got into this funk. And so you got to find a way to get back to some semblance of a balanced offensive attack against a team that knows what they do, and they know who they are in Toronto. It's Kyle and DeMar going in there and making difficult shots, and the rest of the guys playing with energy and effort and waiting for their opportunities to help out the cause.
Brent, what more can LeBron do for the Cavs?
Well, the fact that Ty Lue put him in that last game and played him those extended minutes, and the talk going into the game was that LeBron was going to have a much different approach. And we talked about this right after the game the other night. Only 16 field goal attempts, to me, doesn't scream that he had changed his approach. The post-up game is something that I think that they can still go to. They can not only do it with LeBron, but Kevin Love has had success in doing that. Haven't seen that much in the series, although he did it a couple times last game. And the other part about it is if they can play with some kind of speed, they never sped up like they talked about after making the coaching change with Blatt and Lou. But if Lowry is going in on drives and DeRozan's going in on drives and Cleveland can somehow get that first opportunity off of the rim with Biombo being down underneath and they can explode down the floor to not only find opportunities in transition for both Irving and Love, but then you're going to find these guys falling into three-pointers in the flow of the offense, which might open up some things. And then the open floor is where LeBron is just so dangerous. So those could be a couple of things that you might try to see Cleveland attempt to get to in this game to establish a little bit more of that balanced offensive attack they need.
LeBron has never been a selfish player, quite the opposite. Do you think he has to be a little bit more selfish in Game 5?
Yeah, I think that there's something to the way forcibly he had to play against the Golden State Warriors last year in the finals that had them up 2-1 against Golden State, that he may have to take a few of those possessions or a few minutes at a time where he has to demand the ball and go down low and make some things happen in the post for himself. I think he was really upset at himself in Game 4 when a couple of late possessions in the fourth quarter, he got the ball on switches against Kyle Lowry down on the post and ended up making plays where he fed out to guys on the perimeter. And after the game, alluded to a few plays that he wished he had back. And I guarantee you those are the kind of opportunities, especially in a close game, where he'd rather put the ball into the basket or go into the basket and maybe fight those urges, like you mentioned about being unselfish, to make the play for himself.
Would it surprise you if they put him on DeRozan more tonight?
No. He did a great job on DeRozan, actually. If you look at some of the numbers, the way he defended him, he didn't do an awful job on DeRozan in that game. And so I could see that, again, just for stretches at a time, which gets DeRozan's attention. And then, like I said, if they're able to get the rebound and run out of those situations where DeRozan's behind the play often, you got to think about when players go in to attack and do something offensively, if they're in a position where they've extended themselves beyond the rim, it's really hard to get back on defense, especially if you're a perimeter player and you're having to catch a wave of attack like LeBron and Kyrie that are moving forward. That's where they can gain maybe a couple of possessions. 6-8 points could be a big difference.
With Brent Berry of NBA TV and TNT. One of the interesting scenarios that has surfaced is the return of Valanciunas to this lineup. He was a significant player during the season for the Raptors and in the early part of the playoffs. Biombo has now gotten all of the attention, 41 rebounds in the last two games, and really been an inspirational guy for the Toronto Raptors. But Valanciunas is a now proven, I don't know if he's a veteran yet, but he's getting there. How would you think the Raptors can best use him tonight, assuming he's available? And let's say for 10 or 12 minutes to kind of ease him back in.
Yeah, I think the extra days and having not played in the other game are beneficial for both him and the coaching staff so that they can get a look at him and make sure he gets a good sweat and working out and strengthening that ankle is a good thing to have another 48 hours and
yep.
then the day of the game. But I had a little interesting back and forth with Isaiah Thomas the other night about Valanciunas and how you would put him in. Now we're kind of 2 days later, but I think it's the same set of circumstances. He really is your third offensive option.
Yep.
For what they do. It's mm-hmm. it's Lowry and DeRozan, and then he is a guy you can actually give the ball to. He was on such a great tear before he hurt himself in this playoffs that if one of those two guys is struggling in the game, if Kyle's not having a good shooting game or DeRozan either gets into foul trouble because of who he's guarding or is struggling scoring the ball, you're not going to take Kyle off the floor because what he represents setting the team up in the offense. Then Valanciunas becomes a guy who you might have to lean on. And I think one of the things that's very interesting for Dwayne Casey in the decision-making is if you were to get up 14 points on the road, and I know there's a spirit about how it is that you get up and you don't want to disrupt what that is. To me, that's a great chance to put Valanciunas on the floor. One, you're not putting a ton of pressure on him that your team's down 12 and you've got to feed him to make sure that he makes plays to have you come back in the game. That's a lot of load to give a guy who hasn't played in 8 games and is coming back from an injury. So a lead early to me is a time where if it's 8 or 10 points, there could be 3 or 4 minutes you might steal to see how he unbalances what it is that Cleveland does. And then also you have to look at who Cleveland has on the floor during those instances, because he's not going to be able to catch up with the speed of the game right away. So maybe Kevin Love is the guy who, if he's on the floor, you can play him against Love, or more than likely Tristan Thompson, who's not an offensive threat. So it's going to be interesting to see how Dwayne Casey decides when the time is right. That's the most intriguing part. If I see Valanciunas off the bench ripping off his warm-ups, I want to look at time and score to think about how Dwayne Casey thought about when Valanciunas gets his minutes.
Interesting.
Do you believe in home court advantage in the playoffs?
You know, after you get 4 games in, it's tough to say that there's a massive advantage, because you've been there before.
Right.
You've been in the building. You know the sight lines. You understand the crowd. But more often than not, you understand your opponent and the focus that you have to stop your opponent. I was going to just make one other point about Biombo.
Yeah.
It's great to watch the rebound numbers and all that sort of stuff and the spectacular block shots that he's had at the rim and slow-mo replays and all that stuff and the great spirit that he brings to the team. But one part of his game that has been remarkable that doesn't get brought up a ton, and I'll do it just because I've done the research and that means time, is he is the best screen assist player in the playoffs. He has set more screens. I think Tristan Thompson's second right now in the NBA playoffs, but I think he's about 26 or 27 screens behind Biombo.
Wow.
And a screen assist is a guy who sets a pick that leads directly to the ball handler scoring the basketball. So to think about Biombo's value, and this is with Kyle and DeRozan really not being at their, we know this, at their peak shooting prowess in the postseason, that Biombo has been that much of an impact on their team to give up his body physically to set screens to allow these guys to score. That's one part of his game that's getting grossly underrated, and how much he's impacted how it is that Toronto has kept themselves alive in these playoffs.
Well stated. I mean, it is the way the Raptors have played all year, though, the high pick and roll and the screens, and they continue to do that. It is what has gotten them here. I don't know if you've considered this, but there is an intrigue here, and I'm not suggesting for a second that we're anywhere near this analysis. But if the Toronto Raptors manage to get past Cleveland, and if Oklahoma City polishes off Golden State, the Toronto Raptors would have home court advantage in the NBA final. That is interesting.
Yeah. That's an amazing nugget for Toronto Raptors fans to hang on to until tonight's tip-off.
Yeah, well, at least till then. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Brent, good of you to take time for us tonight. We appreciate it very much at this time of year. We hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
No problem, guys. And if you could email me that other number to get the card, green card.
Oh, just call us.
I'd appreciate that.
Just call us anytime. We'll help you out. It's Brent Berry of NBA on TNT and NBA TV.
I wonder who's the better free throw shooter in his family.
Ooh.
Is John, or is it still the old man?
I think free throw shooting is kind of the thing that you know, if you can do it at age 20, you can do it at age 80, wouldn't you think?
Oh, yeah. And the way Rick Barry used to do it, I mean, he was my favorite player as a kid. I loved the way Rick Barry played.
The logo.
No, that's Jerry West.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But Rick Barry, and when he was with the Warriors, and my goodness gracious, what a player he was.
Yeah, in an era where the game was entirely different, too.
Totally.
Entirely different. You know, it was not dominated by big men, although it's not dominated by big men again. But it was a game, it was more, much more of a passing game, much more of a driving game.
Pretty physical, too, though, Bob. It was
very physical.
When you could put your hand on the body there when you could guard, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, now you can put your arm on the body. I don't know how much different that is.
Oh, it's a lot different.
Well, you can do the forearm thing now.
But, I mean, when you talked about the years of the guy.
Well, that's how I learned to play.
I know.
I haven't played since you couldn't do that, so I can't even tell you exactly what the difference is.
Last time you played, there wasn't a three-point line, Bob.
Well, last time I played, there was a peach basket, not a not a rim and a
Coach Naismith a said shoot.
I knew him before Kansas stole him. It's 25 before the hour. We'll take the break. When we come back, Barry Melrose, hockey, Blues, and the Sharks tonight. Are we going to have another Game 7? We'll talk about it when primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Danger in the shape of something wild. Stranger dressed in black, she's a hungry child. No one.
Sixteen before the hour. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks. There's a basketball game tonight in Cleveland, Ohio. But there's also a hockey game. The Blues will try and force Game 7 against the Sharks tonight. If they do that, they would match the Pittsburgh Penguins, who managed to force a Game 7 by winning in Tampa last night. Are the Blues capable? I suppose they are. But will they? Barry Melrose of ESPN joins us on the telephone. Mr. Melrose, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Who do you like tonight, Blues, Sharks?
I think the Sharks. I think that I love the way they played last game. I know the teams have been taking turns playing good, but they showed a lot of moxie last game. They showed a lot of strength. The power play looked on top of itself. Goaltending, Jones didn't look great, but he made the saves when he had to. The defense looked rock solid. Vlasic, I think, is getting stronger and stronger every game this series goes. And St. Louis is having trouble putting the puck in that. Tarasenko, no points in this series. You know, Backus is playing hurt. He's not quite the same as he was earlier in the series. So I think this is a ripe time for San Jose to take care of business and move on to the Stanley Cup final.
I'd make the argument the Sharks guys are playing with house money now. I mean, even if they lost this series, it would still be viewed as a pretty successful playoffs overall. You know, I know they want to get to the final. I know they want to win the Stanley Cup. But the expectations were a lot lower this year than they have been, hell, for the last decade, maybe. On the other hand, what happens to the Blues, Barry, if they go down in this series? Do they have to re-examine where they are at?
I think they have to re-examine, but I don't think they have to blow it up. That team is you know, second in the toughest division in hockey. Right now, they have the most points, so they would get home ice if they do happen to make a Game 7 and win. They've got a lot of young players. They're not an old team. Obviously, Backus has to be re-signed. You know, defense is rock solid. They got an excellent defense. So they're close to being really good. Obviously, they beat Chicago in a Game 7. Nobody beat Chicago in a Game 7. And then they won another Game 7 against Dallas, a very talented team. So I like the Blues team. I don't know what will happen with Ken if they lose. They didn't renew his contract, give him a new deal. So he's playing out the last year of his contract. That might be an interesting scenario, what happens with him. But I think the Blues are a team that's going to be good for a number of years. And you look at Fabry, he's getting better and better. Schwartz is a heck of a young player. Tarasenko, although he's not playing well in the playoffs, is a superstar. So the Blues have got a good future ahead of them. I think they're a very good franchise.
You touched on Martin Jones, Barry. What's it like to manage a two-goalie system? I mean, how difficult is that in a series, in a situation like this where you've got Jake Allen and Brian Elliott?
Well, what's the saying in football? If you got two quarterbacks, you don't have any. I'm old school. I like one goaltender. I like one guy taking the bull by the horns. But it just more and more common. Whether the pressure on the coach, he doesn't have a game to throw at a goaltender to get his confidence up. You look at Vasilevsky, the job he's done in Tampa Bay. But then you look at the Dallas system, two highly paid veteran goaltenders, and they couldn't get the job done. Sometimes it's just too easy to pull a goaltender. It's turned into that way. It used to be a big decision to pull your starting goaltender, a veteran goaltender, but now it just happens all the time. So it works. Obviously, Martin Jones is really the only goaltender in the playoffs right now that hasn't been pulled. He was pulled late in the game, but it wasn't from playing bad. It was just to give him a rest. But all the other teams are going with two goalies, and one of those teams that go with two goalies might win the Stanley Cup.
We only got a couple of minutes here, and I want to give you an opportunity to say something about John Brophy. He was an interesting character, really rough around the edges. Was he a good coach?
Depends what type of team you had. If you had a type of team that just needed motivation and a guy that could make it fun playing, Brophy was the guy. He stressed effort, he stressed passion, he stressed physical play. Have a beer with you after the game. But that was the way old school guys were. Mm. The new generation with X's and O's and systems and stuff, that wasn't Brophy's strength. But he's one of the great guys. I met him in 1977. He was coaching Cincinnati's farm team in Hampton Roads, and I had just been drafted by Cincinnati. And Brophy, we used to sit around, drink beer, and talk about the Eastern League because I just love stuff like that. And Brophy was the toughest guy in the Eastern League. Like, when you're the toughest guy in the Eastern League,
that's tough.
You're a Navy SEAL. That's how tough you are. And we just lose the and then I talk with other old guys like Bill Dineen or Tom McVie, and all those stories are intertwined. They'd be talking about Brophy, and Brophy would be talking about them. So I always wish that I could have got about five of those old-timers in a room with a tape and just let them talk for about 3 hours about the WHA and the miners and the buses and all the stories. It would just it would have made an unbelievable archive for the NHL.
Guy like Brophy survive in this game now, you think, or no?
No. Brophy's strengths are not what these coaches are all about. A guy like me don't even survive in these years now. So it's a different time for and Brophy is a different guy. But you love him, you'd go through the wall for him, you'd do whatever he told you, and if you played hard for him, he'd have your back no matter what happened.
Barry, we're up against the clock, but quickly, Pittsburgh or Tampa, who do you like?
I think Tampa. I think Tampa, just like last year with the Rangers, ended up losing game six, had to walk into New York and win that game, and I think they won 1-0. So I think Vasilevsky's playing great. I think Kucherov will have a big game. I think Hedman will rebound. I didn't think Hedman had a great game. Up to his standards. I expect so much out of that guy. But obviously it's going to hinge on Crosby. If Crosby scores, Pittsburgh wins. The numbers just bear that out.
Barry, thanks a lot for tonight. Enjoy the game tonight and the rest of the playoffs, and we'll talk again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Take care.
Barry Melrose, ESPN hockey analyst.
Barry talked about a Sidney Crosby. The Penguins have won 3 games this series. Sidney Crosby has the game-winning goal all 3 games.
What do you expect?
Well,
what do you expect tonight, first of all?
Well, Scotty Upshaw is going to play for the Blues. They're going to really try to manage the forecheck and try to be a lot more physical in the shark zone and create opportunities. If they can do that, then the Blues can win. And the Blues have actually played better on the road this year in the playoffs than they've played at home. So I would not be surprised to see St. Louis win tonight. And, with my luck in picking games these days, I'm going to pick the Penguins to win tomorrow night.
Well, that's good, because we may not be here tomorrow and you may not have the opportunity to be wrong. I mean, make a selection. Which are not two different things, by the way. Our thanks to Barry Melrose.
It's just like being at home.
Brent Barry. That's why I do it, John. Just so you feel, comfortable. At home. Just so you feel like you're at home.
You're doing a marvelous job, Robert.
You're welcome. Once again, Barry Melrose, Brent Barry, and Keith Olbermann all on this program. Barring unforeseen weather conditions, we will not be on tomorrow. You'll enjoy the Blue Jays and the New York Yankees. That being the case, we'll see you Friday. Good night from Toronto.